If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.
Pixel Sift.
And welcome to Pixel Sift. If this is your first time listening to the show, welcome. Here on Pixel Sift, we speak to creative minds behind video games and interactive media and learn more about their stories. What does it take to make an experience that you love? My name is Fiona, and joining me tonight is my co-host Viv. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Now, this is episode 173, and joining us to share their game is design manager Rick Stem and production artist Robin Wilson-Davey from Pickpock. Hey, thanks for joining us, guys.
Super excited. This stuff is great. Love what you guys do. Thanks for the support.
We can't wait to find out more about your game and what you've learned along the way to make it, so let's jump in.
Hey there. If you're enjoying the show and you want to hear more, subscribe to Pixel Sift on Apple Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Spotify, or listen on pixelsift.com.au. See you there.
Agent Intercept is a third-person driving game where you play as an agent using a slick, souped-up, transforming vehicle to stop a criminal organization. So for those learning about Agent Intercept for the first time, could you describe it to us?
Yeah, Agent Intercept is every car chase ever. It is the feeling of being a super spy. It is all the best moments of action from action movies and car chase movies and espionage movies, like distilled into an essence with you in charge and you in the driver's seat.
So what inspired you to make the game? Like you said, it encompasses so much. What first made you go, let's make a mobile game for this?
Yeah, that comes actually before both of our time. I came in at the very beginning of the project, but not before the early prototyping of. And that came from the opportunity from Apple Arcade, where they wanted to work with us, and we gave them a number of pitches, including a pitch that was inspired by Spy Hunter. And that idea, or as our chief design officer, Andy Sabathwaite, said, not Spy Hunter, but your memory of what Spy Hunter felt like. So that is, again, the essence of these awesome action driving games. And that was the pitch that they really liked. So it got developed. There was a quick prototyping period just to see, does this game work? Can we get some content for Apple Arcade? And then once we got it out and it felt good and Apple liked it, we realized there was just so much more we could do with the game, and thus built out more missions and more modes and a story campaign and continued improvements, and the team expanded until we have what we think is a pretty nice premium game right now.
Just to clarify, you built this game for Apple Arcade. It wasn't a game that was in development and then pitched to Apple.
Correct. Yeah. Apple came to us for the opportunity. We gave them several pitches. This is one they like. And so it was developed in conjunction with them, where the Apple Arcade model is they help fund the beginning of the game. And then there's some kind of contractual agreement of profits thereafter. So they had the opportunity, but we pretty quickly latched onto it because the vision of the game was so clear. Like, it was this outside opportunity where Apple's like, we want to work with you, and we pitched this game. But it didn't take long for us to go oh yeah, this action game is great. Like, we all understood the feel of what a super spy was like, and we really thought there was so much we could do with that.
And speaking of vision, one thing that really caught my attention was the art style of the game. It's super bright and vibrant. Robin, could you tell us a little bit more about this?
So it kind of leans very heavily into these sort of drawings from the 60s and 70s and kind of old spy movie posters, like old James Bond stuff. I think a lot of those images have a lot of kind of fun and kind of like this kind of cool, slick lifestyle kind of feeling to them. So we just wanted to lean into that and kind of give the game a really nice kind of retro-ish but kind of sleek, stylized feel.
I like that you said lifestyle, because like our game is not about doing any kind of espionage. It's about that feeling, the lifestyle of being, you know, an unflappable, super stylish spy.
One of the things that comes with spies are like obviously the really cool cars, the gadgets. How important was it to try and incorporate all those things that you kind of associate with spy movies into a singular car? I do know it transforms, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, that was the unique selling point of the game, the transforming spy vehicle. And that was actually one of my guiding principles for the narrative was, because I'm a design manager at Pickpock, but I was narrative designer on this game. So yes, I wrote all the dialogue and I wrote the overarching spy story and, you know, the ideas behind the missions. But part of it is that moment-to-moment gameplay of going, okay, if we want you to feel like you're in control and this awesome transforming spy vehicle matters, we have to put challenges that only this spy vehicle can solve in front of it. So that was thing going like, only the Scepter can solve this situation. And there are multiple times where we even like directly say that to the player, being like, agent, this is a job that only you can handle. So we want the player to feel like only they can do it because they're the only agent capable of piloting the Scepter transforming vehicle. And only the Scepter can get through these larger than life death defying situations. And so it gave us this excuse to put together these ridiculous set pieces that go across different types of terrain and something that impossible, literally impossible to do in normal vehicles. But again, always centers the player. So they feel like they're in charge, only they can do it because they're the best super spy. And like that was a guiding thing to always make you feel like you're the one saving the day, only you, because of this awesome vehicle.
And plus transforming stuff always looks cool. You definitely see a lot of cool reactions when people see it transform for the first time. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's been some of the best part of the streams is those first transforms when we see the streamers' reactions. That carried through to the overarching narrative, too. I don't want to give any spoilers, but I thought, like, what's the cool... The unique selling point is this transforming spy car. So I knew that that transformation aspect needed to be like seeded into the overall narrative too, because it was so cool. So you'll have to play the game to see how it actually pans out in the story. But that was such a like forefront of the vision. So the good part about that is we can author these incredible larger than life cinematic set pieces, which maybe you can talk about a little bit in a sec. But it means that, yeah, you're not controlling when you can transform it. And so we had to make it feel earned and feel part of the narrative. So part of that was storytelling, right? So we'd have a situation where like you're chasing a helicopter, but then it shoots a missile at the city, but you have no way to get to the city. So you transform into a boat and you're able to save the day by taking that shortcut. Or, you know, a villain comes out of nowhere and knocks you off road, but you transform into off road mode. So you're able to stay on and do that. So we tried to make all the story beats support that transforming. So it didn't feel like you were just randomly running around. But again, it felt like you were deliberately, because you're a slick super spy, doing it at the right time to solve the problems. Our level designers were also really excellent at understanding the fun of each vehicle and making the moment-to-moment gameplay great. So going, okay, you're going to transform into a boat. That handles differently. What can we do with that? You're transforming into the sled mode, and that has really wide handling and can get big air, so let's put a lot of jumps in. You know, the car is tighter control, so you're going to have more enemy fighting. So our level designers were great at going, okay, you're in this mode. What's fun about this mode? Let's build the gameplay around that.
I think there was a lot of creativity as well, because we could only fit in so many modes. And I think we were like, oh, well, you know, what else can we do with that type of vehicle? Like, for example, the sled mode, which you think first is like just for Arctic stuff. And they're like, well, maybe that would work if you were in like really loose sand. And so that kind of opened up a much broader kind of range of environments. And it's kind of same with the jet mode. We're like, yeah, you can fly in the sky, but maybe where else can you fly a jet? And just kind of, we found...
underground in tunnels to the center of the earth, for example.
Yeah.
Well, were there like many vehicles that you had to cut out during the game design process because of just how many that you could put in there?
No, it was the opposite, really. We started with a tight set of just car and boat and off-road and left it at there. And then as the game expanded and we felt good about it and felt that there was something there, we added on the sled mode, which then added to, we added on the aerial mode. So it was actually... we were smart about scoping small and then expanding from there.
So with the art side, what were some of the challenges when creating the look for the game, especially when it's so fast paced for the player?
It's tricky because especially initially we were quite on mobile, you know, you have a lot of restrictions about what you can fit in and kind of creating things that feel like you're getting a good sense of speed when everything is kind of quite flat. So I think a lot of the stylization that we kind of leaned into, I think, helps with a lot of that. You have areas of quite kind of flat color, but they flash past a lot in alternation. And then as we brought the game onto Steam, obviously that opened things up a lot more, and we were able to add lots of kind of cool like motion blurring effects that kind of helped to sell that sense of speed even more.
One thing that helped us too is to greater and lesser extent, Rob and I both have film backgrounds, so I would definitely be able to write the cutscenes that I had in mind with a filmic language, not that these specific shots were needed, but so that you could understand the emotion and go, okay, here's your intent with the movement, here's your intent with the story flow, here's your intent with the emotion, now I can bring that to life in my way. So it was easy for us to communicate and easy for me to go, here's what we need, but you do you and use your skills to make it as good as possible. And that I think really helped with all that too.
And now we read that part of the game was partially inspired by the PS2 game Spy Hunter. What were the challenges of trying to make the game original while still being a bit reminiscent of the PS2 game?
Yeah, so it's not a set remake of Spy Hunter. That was just a source of inspiration. So I think it helped. Again, I think I said this earlier, our chief design officer, who was early lead designer of the game, said it's not Spy Hunter, it's your memory of what Spy Hunter was. Because Spy Hunter, by the way, second game I ever played in my life. It was the second game we got for Nintendo when I owned when I was a kid, and the second video game I ever played. So I have strong memories of Spy Hunter, but it's not a great game. It's very repetitive, and it's really hard. I don't remember that. What I remember is zooming forward and firing machine guns. I remember, you know, having my mind blown when you turned into a boat. I remember the good feeling of the helicopter chasing you and you getting the missile and taking down the helicopter. Like those moments of, feeling in control and fast and power and these cool gadgets going through. And so it was that, again, it was about the lifestyle, the feeling. Like, how do we make you feel like a super spy? How do we make you feel graceful while doing the impossible and carry that forward? So, and again, that vision was pretty clear. And that gave us a lot of freedom because it was this great, like, again, we knew what the feel was, but we had so much freedom to get that feeling across.
Yeah, I think one of the things we came back to a lot is that it's kind of supposed to be, everyone is supposed to feel like a super spy who plays. Only a few people are supposed to feel like the elite sort of thing. So I think there was a lot of kind of back and forth with balancing to make sure that things weren't too hard so that whatever you're doing, you always felt like super slick and awesome, but there were still some kind of trickier extra things that you can reach for if you're a better player.
Yeah, that's why we added the intel objectives and all these different high score modes and time trials and score chase and global leaderboard. So again, if you just want it for the story, you just jump into the driver's seat and are totally immersed. But there's ways for you to go back, get those objectives, or go back and unlock the leaderboard and then place first in that leaderboard and learn more about our combo system to really maximize your points and how to chain together combos and how to do all the stunt bonuses. And which is also a great thing that I was thinking about the other day. I feel like one good thing we did was marry like the action movie tropes to the gameplay. So, for example, again, I'm not spoiling because this is in the first level. In an action movie, a plane or helicopter like running at you and shooting bullets and the action hero like running between the strafing bullets is an action movie trope. And that's something we do in the game, but you also get a point bonus for doing it and can keep your combo alive for doing it. So something you want to do because it's an action movie thing, but we're also mechanically rewarding that thing. And so it just goes hand in hand.
And now the game did release back in 2019 on Apple Arcade, but not that long ago, it did release on Steam. What were some of the challenges of adapting a mobile game to a Steam PC platform?
That was mostly you, my man. I mostly got to sit back and go, it looks amazing. Great job.
Yeah, I think the main thing that we were aware of is making it feel like it deserved to be on that kind of bigger platform. So we spent a lot of time kind of adding various improvements and tweaks to the graphics, making things just look a lot prettier. And then also, there's like a lot more content that we spent time making, more game modes, like the score attack, kind of rounding out the main story missions with a whole bunch of extra side missions, some of which are still in development.
Yeah, so, you can look forward to a bunch of some of my favorite ones too. Some of the ones that haven't released yet are some of my favorite of the side missions.
So mostly just like making everything bigger and more, and then also making it still fit on like Yeah, making them both kind of feel the same.
Right, because everything's got to come back to Apple and will come back. So there's everything on the Steam version will be on the Apple Arcade version. And yeah, that's hard with all the graphical improvements you guys did, making sure they ran. And the UI looks really great, like excellent work on that.
Mm.
So what was the reception like when people found out it was being brought to Steam and had all these new added levels and bits and bobs?
The best thing for me is the reactions on the streamers' faces. That's where I could see, because we didn't have like a huge marketing blitz pre-Steam. So certainly we were excited internally, and we did have some people commenting on Apple Arcade going, oh, this game is cool. I wish I could play it, you know, outside of Apple Arcade. So we got that a lot, which is great. But yeah, to me, that moment of like when it drops and people, when they see that first transformation moment, you know, when they see these impossible, when we create a completely impossible obstacle and they're like, no, they'll never do that. And then you do it and everyone's like, what the, we can't share their reactions because there are so many like just genuinely just like swearing as they're like, what the hell was that? So it's been great. Like seeing that our vision again of this crazy stylish, high energy world saving, like over the top world is like coming through to people and we're getting those like raw emotions coming across. And I think being able to play it on a bigger screen, having the graphical improvements, having the voiceover to tell the story, just creates that immersion that allows those feelings to come across.
Yeah. I think there are quite a few comments like, oh, I wish this was on Steam or like on any other platform. So it's nice to be able to kind of deliver that to those people, I guess.
Yeah, because I feel like it's a good mobile game. Like the controls are simple and you can play it in bite-sized chunks. So it actually really works as a mobile game. But again, because it's so cinematic, which is mainly our job there, like it plays really great on the big screen too.
Now, you both mentioned before that you have a bit of more of a background in screen production. How did you first get your start in video game developing?
Take it, Roman. I have a long, convoluted story.
Yeah. All right. So this is actually my first. This is my first time working in video games. Yeah. I come from kind of an animation, film, and TV background, where I've kind of specialized in kind of putting sequences together. So I think I'm hoping what happened is that they looked at my resume and were like, "Oh yeah, this is the guy that we should bring in to make these big, crazy cutscenes that." That Rick was writing.
Yeah. Love working with you, man. You are, it'd be hard for me to picture working with someone that didn't have your background to do that. Brag a little. You've worked on some cool stuff.
Yeah, I worked on things like Lego Batman and Lego Ninjago and the Thunderbirds Go TV series. So, yeah, lots of stuff with explosion vehicles sweeping around. So, yeah, I think it was just right time, right place for me, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm a big advocate of that. And I think Stu, our chief artistic director, is as well. People with varied backgrounds do bring new skills to the games industry. And so, yeah, good fit. And then, yeah, I have a very varied background. I have a degree in film, but never actually worked in it. I worked in instructional design for a long time, creating e-learning for what is now the world's largest medical records provider. So like millions of people look at the e-learnings I made. And so that taught me a lot about design and UX and interactivity. I'm also a playwright. I've actually been a playwright longer than I've been a game designer. So I've had a lot of shows produced. And one of my specialties is interactive theater. So I've done a lot of transmedia stuff and theater that the audience interacts with and theater that incorporates tech. So that was natural. Though I have also worked in educational games. I was an indie game designer for many years and made my own games while also working as a working artist in teaching game design at an art school. So I have like instructional design, video game design, teaching, film, theater, weird transmedia art. I'm also a kung fu instructor and a fight choreographer. So like I just think about movement and action a lot. I think one of the reasons we get together because we know how to like tell stories through movement and action. And all that mixes together and makes me a good game designer, hopefully.
That's quite the repertoire. What made you interested in that, I guess, in the field of stuff?
Yeah, to me, it was video games were cool, not just because I love playing them, but for me, there's something magical about them being interactive. They're really, I mean, I can go on to a whole screed about how all art is interactive. but really, more than anything, video games really only exist with a player, and you have to think about your audience. And there's something magical about letting people create their own stories. So like I did a lot of role-playing games. I still play D&D and love GMing because I love creating experiences that people feel are their own and they own, and video games just do that better than anything else. So that was me. There's the magic to the interactive art form.
Yeah, I don't know. It's always been like an area of interest for me. And I think there's a lot of opportunities for kind of exploring the cinematic side of games in a way that's like more interesting than just seeing cutscenes and kind of exploring how the player can be involved in that sort of stuff. So yeah, I saw an opening to kind of get involved and was like, oh yes, awesome. Yeah.
I think that really helps this game. So we've got the cinematic background, we've got the theatrical background, and then we both have video games, and like all of that is evidenced in this game, I think. You know, that's our trifecta, but we have amazing tech people building, you know, incredible tools for the team to use and making it feel good. Great UX and UI, so everything comes across. Like, obviously, amazing production artists. The level designers are fantastic. Even just the support, you know, QA people playing the game all the time to make sure it feels good. Yeah, we had a really fantastic team. You're right. We need to give them all credit. We're here representing them. We have a lot of amazing, and they all have cool, diverse backgrounds.
Yeah.
So what is the industry scene like in New Zealand? Like you were saying, you've got such an amazing big team all working together and providing so many new and like individual experiences.
Yeah, it's growing in a way that I really like, because San Antonio, Texas, which is where I was from, I'm from Wisconsin, if there's anyone watching who knows where that is. But San Antonio was similar in that there wasn't a big indie. Austin had a big scene, San Antonio didn't. And so I got on the ground floor of that, and I was helping to like found an IGDA chapter and like get a group of gamers together and connect other indies and get booth set packs so we could connect with others and like grow the scene. And New Zealand's a little farther than that, but it has some of that same energy of going like, hey, actually, we're not alone. There is a scene here. There's other studios, there's internationally known studios with popular games with millions of players, but there's still room for us to connect and support each other. There's still room for the government to like understand what we do and put money into it. So it's at this cool place where I think it's recognized and it has a reputation. Like 3 of the 60 launch games are from New Zealand or New Zealand, Australia in Apple Arcade. So like a way higher percentage than you would expect, having like multiple launch games of the 60 launch titles from New Zealand. So it is an internationally known industry, but there's still room to grow. And I think that's a good thing. Again, it makes us support each other and it makes us get out in the community and try and support universities so we can get more talent in, try and talk to the government so they understand what we're doing, try and get investors involved, trying to get people to move here. So it still has that energy of like, yeah, let's grow, we can do this. Sorry, I rambled a lot. I don't know if you have any thoughts too, like what, you know, from your more outside perspective.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the things have come a long way, but it does still feel small enough that there's kind of a bit of a community vibe with lots of kind of smaller scale things going on. I know you've been involved with like some of the talks, like for developing narrative for games and stuff like that.
Yeah. I like that aspect, right? There's, you know, I've talked at multiple universities and it's great to do that. We've got NZGDC coming up, where I'll be giving a talk there. We have these other groups like Wellingtaru and Game Developers of Wellington and Kiwi Jam. And again, you will see people like, you know, success stories, people from Dinosaur Polo Club or Grinding Gear who makes Path of Exiles. Like they'll show up at these local events and support people, and it's really great. While also having some up and coming indies.
I wanted to ask more about like the artistic approach when making or when creating anything in general, not just video games. Robin, what are, I guess, your first steps when you when approaching a certain idea? Do you like know where to begin, or do you like take heavily from I guess a concept that someone gives you? Like talk us through that.
Yeah, I'd say definitely here on Agent Intercept at Pickpock, we have an awesome art direction team. I think they, along with the concept art team, do a lot of the heavy lifting when it comes to defining the visual style. And then kind of once you're kind of in the weeds of making props and vehicles and whatever, I think there's a little bit more back and forth. But usually it's, you know, like you look for references that feel appropriate, and maybe you have a crazy idea that you know fits whatever crazy thing you're doing at the time. But a lot of conversations between a lot of really talented people, I'd say.
And is the process between creating game art and animated film, for example?
Not too different. I couldn't speak to it very like very kind of intelligently, because where I was working before was like quite. Like in the, I don't know how much you know about like layout, but that's kind of like where everything is still kind of like gray and gray boxes, and you're kind of just moving like very, very early versions of things around in space. But I'd say that generally I'd say, yeah, you have a concept team who come up with things. Some projects I've worked on, like directors or people who've been working on things, are kind of involved in generating ideas, which I think is probably similar to how the team works here on Agent Intercept. And then you kind of, you know, you're like, yeah, we have this crazy idea. And then the art department are like, cool, we'll come up with a bunch of cool stuff. What do you think? And we're like, oh, yeah, that looks great. And yeah, kind of everything just kind of builds on top of each other.
And now, Rick, you were saying before that you've are a playwright, you've written for a whole bunch of different theatre productions. What are the differences between writing for something on stage as opposed to writing for a visual media such as games and anything online?
Yeah, there's a lot of differences. Might be easier to talk about the similarities, but obviously scope is one, right? On a stage, you're limited to what you can actually build and do in real time. And in a game, you can go in, you know, into space or travel through time, you know, with relative ease. Though I think that's actually one of the things that makes me a good over-the-top game narrative designer, is that one of the things I love about theater is that imagination of going, okay, we do have this limited space, but can I still transport you to somewhere else? Like, I have a video game show and we have these giant monster battles that are all done with stagehands doing little monster puppets and moving little magic effects around, you know, dressed in black, and just going like, can I evoke that same feeling within these limited constraints? And so that gives you a lot of big imagination. Obviously, theater is more focused on the actors. Of course, that made me, I think, hopefully helps me write, you know, good dialogue and work with voice actors. But the game, the player is the main actor in a game, so you really need to center them. Whereas in theater, you might have an ensemble and each of the different characters are equally important. So you definitely have to think differently to center the player that way. The thing that I like about both of them is that they're collaborative. In both aspects, the only way to put on a theater show is to work with actors and director and dramaturge and set designers and costume designers and lighting people and sound people, et cetera, et cetera. And same thing with video games. You can only make a game with tech and programming and UI and various aspects of art and QA and, you know, various types of designers. But that is always going to make it better, because there's always going to be like, I have a kernel of a story and I believe in this story, but how that story comes to life is mostly in everybody else's hands. And they're going to bring things to the table that I would have never thought of that just makes it better. And so I think like the best thing I've learned as a writer in both media is to go, if I can excite people about the idea, either like literally through an action movie or just a vision that's clear and gets people hooked into you, then they're going to bring their all to it. And then they're going to make it better than I ever could.
So what would be the most challenging aspect of game development for to the both of you?
Yeah, for me, it's scope, which is classic, because I just want to do things big and crazy, and I want to tell stories, and I want everybody to have a chance to do their best. And so I'm getting better at it. I get better every year, but it's an age-old issue that, it's hard to constrain it, which is often better. I think it's better in the end when you constrain it, but I think it's okay to start big if you know how to bring it in. So I've gotten better at still starting as big as possible, but knowing that we start as big as possible, get people excited about the possibilities. But we're actually going to scope it in, and it's going to be better and tight for that. So yeah, just forcing myself to scale it down.
I'd say it's probably a similar thing for me. I think for me, I have to remember not to say yes to everything. I think there's a lot of people, a lot of the team have lots of really good ideas all the time. And as a production artist, you know, when someone's like, oh, yeah, do you think we can just like add this thing in here? You know, and will that be that? You know, and you're kind of like, yeah, that sounds great. And then maybe afterwards you're like, oh, wait, it actually sounds like a lot of work. just kind of balancing those things out, I think, is another thing I'm kind of learning to do as well.
Yeah, because if you just put you and I in a room, like, we spitball all day and come up with the greatest cutscenes ever, that and the game would never get released.
It sounds like when you two are together, there's lots of ideas flowing and lots of things that you both want to achieve with not only this game but others too.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that made Agent Intercept good, is we, like, whenever I was pitching a new chapter, like the overall story, I'd get the entire team into the room and go, here's what I'm thinking, and then just let people flow with ideas. Usually it would just be building up, what about with this, what about this, but it would also be useful for tech going like, oh, I think that's going to be too hard, or art going, oh, we've been working on this cool asset, can you work that in? So there was always these moments of the whole team coming together, and then likewise, when we embarked on a level, there would be these early cutscene meetings where we'd have representatives from tech and design and production art, as well as us getting getting people in a room to talk about, again, both the what's possible, what are good ideas, but also where are the constraints, where do we get the most bang for the buck, what's there. So but having everybody in a room just feeding off of each other is really great. And yeah, we have a lot of good moments that design moments, you know, story moments that came from level designers, or you know, in really cool visual moments that came from tech people. So it's fully collaborative effort.
Yeah, I think it's really nice. Although I think people were keeping kind of technical constraints in mind, I think generally when it came to like the quality of ideas, I don't think anyone ever said, "Oh, is that too crazy?" Like, it was always like, "Oh no, that's fine," or you know, "That's not crazy enough.
Yeah,
you know, we can push it further."
Yeah, it was more, "How can we do that?"
Yeah, yeah.
Now, for those just starting in the game developing industry, what advice would you give to people who aren't sure where to begin or what to do?
Well, there's the classic, it's cliche, so I'll make sure to say something else as well, but just make games, you know, just whatever it is, you know, use simple systems. If you're using GameMaker, that's great. If you're making board games with, you know, pieces you find, you know, in a craft cabinet, that's great. Like, just do whatever you can to make stuff. Participating in game jams and getting hands-on is great. So everyone says it, but it's true. The other thing I'd say, this is the opposite end of that, but I'm a big believer in this, and I think we touched on it with our backgrounds, but like, live an interesting life. You can't just be like super hardcore in on one skill set. I mean, you need a minimum level of skills. And if you're going to apply to be a production artist, they're going to ask for certain proficiencies with softwares and a portfolio of things. So don't want to downplay that. But also, like, where the fun comes from, where the collaboration comes from, where the connection to your audience comes from, is that you get out there and you live an interesting life and you meet interesting people and you do cool things and you draw on all that stuff. And that helps you get cool ideas out there, and it helps you know how to work with people, and it helps you know how to understand your audience, and it helps you have different perspectives of people who might be playing your game. So I think while, yes, there is certainly a barrier of hard skills you need to overcome, I think, like, you got to get out and do weird stuff. And that makes you a better artist.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode tonight. You can pick up Agent Intercept now on Apple Arcade and Steam. Thanks so much for joining us on the show, Rick and Robin. It was great having you guys on board and finding out more.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks for having us.
Pixel Sift is produced by Sarah Island, Daniel Eng, Adam Christo, and myself. Mitchell Lowe is our senior producer, and Gianni Di Giovanni is our executive producer. As always, we'll be putting links to everything we talked about in the show notes on our website, pixelsift.com.au.
You can also join us on Discord. We'd love to have you there. That's pixelsift.com.au/Discord, where you can share your creative work, talk about any topics you want, games, and anything else, really. So that's pixelsift.com.au/Discord. If you like what we do, can we ask a favor? We need your help to share the show. So tell a friend, subscribe. Yourself and your brothers and sisters, maybe start someone's journey into podcasts, because we know that getting started is tricky, but once you're in, you'll love it too much to leave.
Next week on the 1st of July, we'll be back with Pixel Sift Plays, playing one of the many indie games featured on the show. That's all for this week. Thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you next time.
If you're in the market for a super addictive puzzle game, you have to check out Mini Motorways on Apple Arcade. It's a city planning strategy puzzler with an incredibly satisfying gameplay loop. Enjoy unlimited access to over 200 incredibly fun games with no ads and no in-app purchases. From puzzle and adventure games to sports, racing, and multiplayer action games, everyone can count on finding something to love. Head to sifter.com.au/arcade to start your free trial of Apple Arcade today. That's sifter.com.au/arcade for a free 1 month trial of Apple Arcade, and you'll be supporting independent video games journalism. New subscribers only, $9.99 a month after free trial. Plan automatically renews after trial until cancelled.